Vanjakaputubhyascha Kripasindhu Vaibhacha Pratitanam Pavinibhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. We're hearing a very wonderful pastime, very chocked full of lessons for us all about a disruption of a sacrificial performance. Actually, the sacrifice went on anyway, but there was a disruption in it where Daksha, who was a very powerful person, in this sacrifice, he wasn't shown in what his mind was sufficient respect by Lord Shiva, who was such an exalted personality. And what did Lord Shiva do? How did he disrespect or neglect Daksha? He did not stand up when Daksha walked in. Lord Shiva was such an elevated personality that there was no need for him to stand up as an offering of respect. But Daksha thought, in his mind, he was worthy of respect even from Lord Shiva. In other words, he was proud. And because he was proud, he became angry at Lord Shiva. And because he became angry, he criticized him. And the envy that he was actually feeling in his heart burst forward in his words. So, this is how our life moves forward, or rather backwards. When we become proud, and what do we become proud of? We have so many reasons why we are proud, and they're all false reasons. Because one should be proud of something that is truly his, something that is truly ours. When we leave a place, we take it with us. We shouldn't be proud of something that is borrowed or just temporarily ours. So what in this world do we actually take with us when we die? We take the consciousness that we have. But what else do we take with us? Do we take our fame, our name, our wealth? No, that remains with the body. When the body dies and turns into either ashes or is buried in the ground or whatever. So practically speaking, in this world, we have nothing to be proud of. But Daksha was very proud. And that which we have that is opulent or attracts others is our fortune. That means that it is a gift. It is grace. It is mercy given to us by Krishna, by the Lord. So there is nothing to be proud of. Yet, in this world, we all tend to be proud of whatever we have, even if it's a little bit. We have that, and we think we are better than others. And that leads us to great trouble, in that we are insecure in our wealth, in what we have, and we are proud at the same time. So when we see someone who is somewhat better than us, or we fear might one day be better than us, we become envious of them and wish ill for them. And this leads us to still more trouble. Pride, envy, anger. So in this way our heart becomes contaminated by so many horrific tendencies and qualities. So even great persons like Daksha literally means expert, he was expert. So even great personalities have this tendency towards pride, anger, envy, greed. Practically speaking, the reason it is there is there is something false within our heart. We all feel we are lacking something, but we don't know what that something is. The thing we are missing is our relationship with Krishna. But instead of acknowledging and living in that and developing that, we try to plug that hole with something like pride. But that plug or that covering over the hole that we are missing within our heart, that thing we are missing, doesn't truly satisfy us. It is imaginary that the hole is covered. So Daksha, who's experienced pride and envy, he criticized Lord Shiva, cursed Lord Shiva, and as a result of that, the followers of Lord Shiva cursed the followers of Daksha, the Brahminical followers of Daksha, and the Brahmins cursed the followers of Lord. Back and forth there was cursing, and Lord Shiva just walked out. He did not take part. Then there was a sacrifice being performed, another sacrifice being held by Daksha. And Lord Shiva's wife, whose name was Sati, wanted to attend. She asked Lord Shiva, she explained why she wanted to attend. She wanted to see her family members. Really, she wanted to convince her father, was Daksha, don't be envious of Lord Shiva. This is foolish. He is a great soul. But she said she wanted to go. And Lord Shiva said, my dear Sati, don't go. I don't advise this at all. Even though you are very dear to your father, he loves you so much, you are his youngest daughter. When he sees you, he will remember that you are my wife, and because he is envious and angry at me, he will ignore you, and that will cause you so much pain. He will look at you with angry eyes. That will cause you pain when your father does this, because no one can hurt one as much as someone who is close to us. And the closer one is to us in relationship, the more capacity they have to inflict wounds upon us. So Lord Shiva said, don't go. It will be horrible for you. You will regret your relationship with me. But Sati was really wanted to go. So she decided anyway. First she was undecided, walking here and there. Finally she decided to go. And when she got there, unfortunately Lord Shiva's words manifested true, and Daksha neglected her. Although her sisters and her mother welcomed her and offered her presents, because she saw that her father neglected her, and there was no respect given to Lord Shiva, even though he wasn't present. Therefore Sati became very angry and decided that to live in this world known as Dakshayani, the wife of Lord Shiva, was not possible. The daughter of Daksha was not possible for her, because Daksha had, by his neglect, had caused her so much difficulty and pain by his disrespect of her husband. So she decided to kill herself. So in the first part of the chapter, which we read last Saturday, we heard how Sati began speaking to her father very angrily, criticizing him. And she said, my dear father, no one in this world is envious of Lord Shiva. He is kind to all living entities. That which you criticized him for, his kindness to those who have fallen, is his glory. He elevates them. And then in text 17, she continues to describe what she's going to do. Sati continues, if one hears an irresponsible person blaspheme the master and controller of religion, one should block his ears and go away if unable to punish him. But if one is able to kill, then one should by force cut out the blasphemer's tongue and kill the offender. And after that, one should give up his own life. So we are being convinced here and in these verses how heavy it is to be in a critical mood and to blaspheme either God or those who are dear to him, the devotees of God. It is very, very serious. In this world, we tend to lightheartedly, casually criticize others. Oh, this one's like this, and this one's like this, and this is his fault, and that one's that fault. But it's actually very serious when that tendency is turned to the devotees of Krishna, especially the exalted, elevated devotees of Krishna and the Lord. So even to the extent it is said, and this is not the general recommendation, that if someone is critical, one should cut out their tongue so that they wouldn't have the opportunity to criticize again and then kill oneself. Again, this is not the recommended procedure. The recommended procedure is you argue, and if that's not so practical, just leave the place. Don't be tolerant and hear criticism of the Lord or his dear ones, the devotees. Here's what Prabhupada says in his purport. We'll read some of that. The argument offered by Sati is that a person who vilifies a great personality is the lowest of all creatures. By the same argument, Daksha could also defend himself by saying that since he was a Prajapati, the master of many living creatures, and one of the great officers of the great universal affairs, his position was so exalted that Sati should accept his good qualities instead of vilifying him. The answer to that argument is that Sati was not vilifying, but defending. If possible, she would have cut out Daksha's tongue because he blasphemed Lord Shiva. In other words, since Lord Shiva is the protector of religion, a person who vilifies him should be killed at once. And after killing, such a person should give up one's own life. That is the process. But because Daksha happened to be the father of Sati, she decided not to kill him, but to give up her own life in order to compensate for the great sin she had committed by hearing blasphemy of Lord Shiva. The instruction set forth here in Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, is that one should not tolerate at any cost the activities of a person who vilifies or blasphemes an authority. It's all very heavy instructions to impress upon us the seriousness of this point, and we'll hear this quite a few times in the chapter, that one should be very carefully avoid hearing criticism of the Lord or his devotees. And Lord Shiva, Vaishnavanam Tatar Shambhu, he is the greatest of Vaishnavas or worshippers of the Lord Vishnu. So Sati, the daughter of Daksha, the husband of Lord Shiva, said, because you have criticized Lord Shiva, and because what I should do, practically speaking, is kill, cut out the blasphemous tongue, this is the injunction actually, and kill the offender, and then one should give up his own life. But since I can't do that, therefore I shall no longer bear this unworthy body, which has been received from you, who have blasphemed Lord Shiva. If someone has taken food which is poisonous, the best treatment is to vomit. It is better to execute one's own occupational duty than to criticize others. So she's saying that I shouldn't criticize you, I should know what I have to do. Elevated transcendentalists may sometimes forgo the rules and regulations of the Vedas, since they do not need to follow them. Just as demigods might travel in space, while ordinary men may travel on the surface of the earth. Here's Prabhupada's purport. The behavior of the most elevated transcendentalists and that of the most fallen conditioned souls appears to be the same. The elevated transcendentalist can surpass all the regulations of the Vedas. Just as the demigods traveling in space surpass all the jungles and rocks on the surface of the globe, although a common man who has no such ability to travel in space has to face all those impediments. Although the most dear Lord Shiva appears not to observe all the rules and regulations of the Vedas, he is not affected by such disobedience. But a common man who wants to imitate Lord Shiva is mistaken. A common man must observe all the rules and regulations of the Vedas, which a person who is in the transcendental position does not need to observe. Daksha found fault with Lord Shiva for not observing all the strict rules and regulations of the Vedas, but Sati asserted that he has no need to observe such rules. It is said that for one who is powerful like the sun or fire, there is no consideration of purity or impurity. The sunshine can sterilize an impure place, whereas if someone else were to pass such a place, he would be affected. One should not try to imitate Lord Shiva, rather one should strictly follow one's prescribed occupational duties. One should never vilify a great personality like Lord Shiva. In the Vedas, Sati continues, there are directions for two kinds of activities. So she's explaining Lord Shiva's position is above all the rules and regulations. Rather than being criticized for not following them, it should be recognized that he has no need to follow them. Like a person who has already graduated with a PhD in philosophy, he no longer has to take beginner philosophy courses. So the rules and regulations of scriptures, they are meant to set us on the path and make sure our path towards the goal of God realization is straight. But someone who has already fully realized in his relationship with Krishna, for one who's awakened, whose relationship with Krishna is already awakened, the ABC-like steps, you must do this and you must do that, are not required. So Daksha had criticized Lord Shiva for not following the basic rules that the Vedas prescribe for humanity at large. But actually, he was above those rules and regulations, having realized the Lord himself, so therefore it was not actually required that he follow him, nor should he be criticized for not following them. So everyone has specific duties according to one's actual position. And mostly, one should know one's position and one should follow what is prescribed for him and not worry so much about others and he should be doing this and this one should be doing that. That is not so much our business, although we like very much to concern ourselves what others should be doing, because that blocks away our own lacks and neglects in doing what we should be doing. But that is actually a fault. So Sati is going to continue with her analysis of Lord Shiva and his position. And she explains that in the Vedas there are two kinds of activities. Activities for those who are attached to material enjoyment, and activities, on the other hand, for those who are materially detached. So when one's attached, he has one kind of duty, and when one is detached already, one has a second kind of duties. So a consideration of these two kinds of activities, there are two kinds of people who have different symptoms. If one wants to see two kinds of activities in one person, this is contradictory, because you're either attached or detached, and therefore your symptoms and activities should be different, but you can't be attached and detached simultaneously. It's contradictory. But both kinds of activities may be neglected by a person who is transcendentally situated, and she's explaining this is Lord Shiva's position. He is neither attached to matter or detached from matter. He is above it completely. So therefore, he doesn't have to follow any rules in relationship to either what the attached to matter do or the detached to matter do to elevate them further, because he is already further elevated. So she's explaining Lord Shiva's position. My dear father, she says, the opulence we possess is impossible for either you or your flatterers to imagine. She's very strong with him. She's angry. For persons who engage in fruitive activities, that was her father's position, performing sacrifices to gain a material goal. For persons who engage in fruitive activities by performing great sacrifices, are concerned with satisfying their bodily necessities by eating foodstuff offered as a sacrifice. We can exhibit our opulences simply by desiring to do this. This can be achieved only by great personalities who are renounced self-realized souls. Here's Prabhupada's purport. We'll read some of it, a third of it. Sati's father was under the impression that he was exalted in both prestige and opulence, and that he had offered his daughter to a person who was not only poor, but devoid of culture. Her father might have been thinking that although she was a chaste woman greatly adherent to her husband was in a deplorable condition. To counteract such thought, Sati said that the opulence possessed by her husband could not be understood by materialistic persons like Daksha and his followers, who were flatterers and who were engaged in fruitive activities. Her husband's position was different. He possessed all opulences, but he did not like to exhibit them. Therefore, such opulences are called avyakta or unmanifest. But if required, simply by willing, Lord Shiva can show his wonderful opulences, and such an event is predicted here, for it would soon occur. The opulence Lord Shiva possesses is enjoyable in renunciation and love of God, not in material exhibition of sense gratificatory methods. Such opulences are possessed by personalities like the Kumaras, Naradas, Lord Shiva, and not others. You are an offender, Sati said, at the lotus feet of Lord Shiva, and unfortunately I have a body produced from yours. I am very much ashamed of our bodily relationship, and I condemn myself because my body is contaminated by a relationship with a person who is an offender at the lotus feet of the greatest personality. Because of our family relationship, when Lord Shiva addresses me as Dakshayani, which means the daughter of Daksha, I at once become morose, miserable, and my jolliness and my smile at once disappear. I feel very much sorry that my body, which is thus like a bag, has been produced by you, and I shall therefore give it up. So Sati, Lord Shiva would sometimes call her Dakshayani, or the daughter of Daksha, and she would feel very, very bad because she's reminded of her relationship with someone who has offended her husband, Lord Shiva. So very, very painful for her. So she became so sorry. The pain of that, of what she was experiencing due to her father's enmity with Lord Shiva, the pain of what she was experiencing was greater than the pain that she would experience by killing herself. So we can just imagine how much, on one hand, she loved Lord Shiva, and on the other hand, we can imagine what a soft-hearted, tender-hearted young lady she was, and how staunch and chaste she was, deciding to give up her body. I shall therefore give it up. Maitreya, the sage, told Vidura, Maitreya Muni was narrating this to Vidura, O annihilator of enemies, while thus speaking to her father in the arena of sacrifice, Sati sat down on the ground and faced north. Dressed in saffron garments, she sanctified herself with water and closed her eyes to absorb herself in the process of mystic yoga. First of all, she sat in the required sitting posture, and then she carried the life air upwards and placed it in the position of equilibrium near the navel, Because by yoga practice, one can manipulate the prana and the life air and thereby actually move the soul within the body. The purpose of yoga is not to stretch the ligaments and the muscles, and although that is also done in yoga, but the purpose is to be able to manipulate the air, something far more subtle than just health exercises, and to be able to concentrate the consciousness, the citta, fully on the Lord within the heart. To consciousness, to focus the consciousness is the purpose of yoga. Samadhi. Samadhi means when one's meditation is equally focused, fully focused on the Lord. And when one practices yoga, one gains so many powers or abilities. But these abilities or powers, siddhis, perfections, mystic perfections, they are not the purpose of yoga. Rather, in one sense, they are meant to distract us, to see what we really want. They are meant to distract us from the actual path, almost like a test, to see what our actual desire is. Because according to what we desire, we will get that. In this world, this is the law of nature. Saratad bhava bharata yam yam bhapi svaram bhavan chanjat yante kalevaram. According to what we desire, when our mind focuses on that, our body and activities will go in that direction, and that will tend to manifest to us. And therefore the whole field of advertising is based on this. To somehow or another, dayato vishaya pungsan sangas tejo pujayate. Somehow or another, get people to focus on particular products. This is all that advertising is. Focus on this product and think that if you had this, then you would be happy. If you smoke this or buy that or go to this vacation spot, then you will be happy. But actually it's not true. But by focusing the mind on that, we begin to desire it. Sangas tejo pajayate. Attachment develops. And then actually, as the Bhagavad Gita describes, that when we focus our mind on something and attachment develops in that thing, then we lose our memory and we become bewildered. This is what the Bhagavad Gita describes. We lose our memory because even though we may have had 200 tape recorders before in our life, even if we had 10 of them at the same time, even if we surround ourselves with tape recorders or shoes, sometimes we see shoes advertised, and we surround ourselves with thousands of pairs of shoes, can that make us happy? We forget. No, this is just a bluff. And somehow the impression when we look at this advertising, it's psychologically it's made, and they hire. This is one of the biggest job markets. Is if you graduate with degrees in psychology, very often you get hired by the advertising companies. How to manipulate people's mind to separate them from their money, basically. So how to present something in an attractive way so that they want to buy it. Shoes, clothes, what else? Go ahead, I'll give you a chance.
Television.
Yes, that's okay. You're in a subdued mood today. You had a hard day at the distributing prasadam. Ah, I'm sorry to hear that. But there's something good in that flu. Because when we're a little ill, even though it's hard to keep the consciousness up and thinking of Krishna, we understand that we are not invulnerable, that we are tiny, and some little teeny bugs get in our body and slap, we're finished. We lose everything. So We tend to think that's us, and it's my inalienable right to be strong and healthy and chirpy and in good spirits. But it's going to be taken from us, and it can be at any moment. So therefore, we should use that time very wisely and never, never, never be proud of anything, even our health. When we get old and when we hurt and we're weak, we will lose everything that we feel that we're proud of now. So there's actually blessings in these illnesses, although it sure doesn't feel that way when you're sick. So through yoga, actually part of yoga is to have the airs of life circulate in such a way that one doesn't even get sick. Practically speaking, that's what happens to yogis. In India you'll see these powerful yogis, big, they don't lift weights or anything, but there's a big, big chest from doing pranayama, just from breathing, so that the air of life circulates in their body, and they can walk around. In winter, when it's so cold, they can walk around without any sweaters or coats or anything like that. But that's not the purpose of yoga either. But sati is going to demonstrate something that one can do with yoga, and that is leave one's body. The soul can move in such a way that it can leave the body completely. So much control over the soul and its inhabitation within the body. Because she's saying that the body is like a bag. A bag contains something. It has no inherent value in and of itself. It depends what's in the bag. Its value depends on what's in it. So what's in this body, which is like a bag, is the soul, which is so valuable. This is the life that is within the body. Ajo nityam shashvatoyam parano nahanyate anyamane sharire. It is unborn, eternal. And we can all actually perceive this, that the soul, we tend to think, we look at a picture, or look in the mirror and we think this is us. But actually we can all perceive that that which we see in the mirror is not us. Because which we see that in the mirror, I look and I see this person in the mirror. So if this is me, then who is that person who 20, 30, 40 years ago I saw when looking in the mirror? Was that me or is this me? Well, that was me then, and now this is me? No, because I'm still the same person. But how the body changes. But yet, me, the person within the body, never changes. So that person, that soul, that doesn't change, that's nityo, ajo nityam, shashvatam, continuous, everlasting, parano, eternally old. Nahanyate hanyamane shirire, it does not die when the body dies. What a relief to actually realize that. Because so much of our fears in this world, we forget them, but it is there that this is that I'm going to die. This is the greatest fear. What's going to happen when I die? No one wants to die. People sometimes will say, oh, I don't care. But wait till they're in a situation where their life is threatened or they get sick or something like that. Then people care. The only people who don't care are the ones who are healthy and are in no danger. Everyone else is very, very concerned. So how much free of anxiety we would be knowing that we are not this body and that we are eternal. And that when the body dies, the soul transfers to another body according to what our consciousness is focused on at the time of death. That's Siddhatad Bhava Bharata Yam Yam Vapis Bhavam Chajanyante Kalevam. But Sati decided that she was going to move, transfer her soul to another body. She was going to leave this body because that body has a connection with with Daksha. Maybe we can close the window because maybe some of the devotees are called. So first of all, she sat in the required sitting posture. She sat, she carried the life air upwards and placed it in the position of equilibrium near the navel. Then she raised her life air mixed with her intelligence to the heart chakra. And then gradually towards the pulmonary passage. And from there between her eyebrows. What's this one called again? Vishuddha. Vishuddha. No, what's this one? I can't remember. Huh? Anyone know the chakras? I forgot them. This is Vishuddha. These are subtle places of consciousness. And when the soul is moved in this way, then the consciousness becomes more, it is more subtle and refined. So she moved her consciousness towards the pulmonary passage and then between the eyes. Thus, in order to give up her body, which had been so respectfully and affectionately seated on the lap of Lord Shiva, who is worshipped by great sages and saints. Sati, due to anger towards her father, began to meditate on the fiery element within the body. Sati concentrated her meditation on the holy lotus feet of her husband, Lord Shiva, who is the supreme spiritual master of all the world. Thus she became completely cleansed of all taints of sin by focusing her consciousness on the greatest of devotees. Her consciousness became purified. Because according to what we focus our consciousness either becomes contaminated, full of material desires, or free of material desires and purified. Thus she became completely cleansed of all taints of sin and quit her body in a blazing fire by meditation on the fiery elements. Here's Prabhupada's purport. Sati at once thought of the lotus feet of her husband, Lord Shiva, who is one of the three great personalities of Godhead in charge of the management of the material world. And simply by meditating on his lotus feet, she derived such great pleasure that she forgot everything in relationship with her body. This pleasure was certainly material because she gave up her body for another body that was also material, because she took her next birth as Parvati. Had another material body. So it wasn't, if one's consciousness is fully spiritual at the time one leaves one's body, having no material desires, then one in one's next birth will have a fully spiritual eternal body. But if one has material desires, and this is the great challenge of our life, the great, great test of our life, what do we want to have our consciousness like at the moment when we will leave this world? And it will happen to all of us, whether we are young or old, sick or well, no matter whether we are rich or poor, tall or short, irrelevant. We will all leave this world. The soul will leave the body. And according to what the consciousness of the soul at that time is filled with, then we will take our next birth. So what? This is the great mission of our life, to make sure, to ensure, by the time we leave this, our body, when we die, that our consciousness is fully purified and in love with Krishna, and then we will go to the eternal service of Krishna, in loving service of Krishna and the spiritual world. So that is the mission of our life, actually. The pleasure was certainly material because she gave up her body for another body that was also material. But by this example, we can appreciate the devotee's pleasure in concentrating his mind and attention on the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord Vishnu or Krishna. There is such transcendental bliss in simply meditating on the lotus feet of the Lord that one can forget everything but the Lord's transcendental form. That is the perfection of yoga samadhi, or ecstasy. In this verse it is stated that by such meditation she became free from all contamination. And what was that contamination? The contamination was her concept of the body derived from daksha. But she forgot that bodily relationship in trance. The purport is that when one becomes free from all bodily relationships within this material world and simply places himself in the position of an eternal servant of the Supreme Lord, it is to be understood that all the contamination of his material attachment has been burned by the blazing fires of transcendental ecstasy. So there's many points in this, but the main point is that if we can somehow or another learn the art of focusing our mind upon Krishna with great loving attachment, there is such pleasure in that. There is such an ecstasy in that, that it is, practically speaking, inconceivable from the material point of view. And this is the essence of what we are trying to do within the Krishna Consciousness Movement. This is the purpose, is to learn the art of forever, continually focusing our consciousness on Krishna with great devotion. Sarva vidina shedacha itya eva kinkara. This is the purpose. And there's so much ecstasy in that. If one learns that art through chanting Krishna's names, through serving Krishna, through remembering Krishna, through speaking about Krishna, through glorifying Krishna, through worshipping the lotus feet of the deity, through offering prayers to Krishna. If one learns that art, it burns to ashes that practice, and the ecstasy felt from doing that burns to ashes all the material desires which puck our consciousness. There may be so many desires as see, we may want so many things, we may fantasize, only if I could have this, and only if I could buy that, and only if I could get that, and go here, and go there. We may fantasize, only if, and these are all lying like seeds within our heart, waiting for the proper time to sprout. But if we, by focusing our mind on Krishna through devotion, through loving service, if we can achieve the ecstasy of such focused loving service, then those seeds of those material desires will fry in our heart in the fire of ecstasy, and they will never fructify. They'll turn to ashes because they will be minimized by the sweetness of the happiness of love for Krishna. So this is actually one of the secrets of Krishna consciousness. Visya vinivartante nirasyadena raso rajam raso prasya param disvanavartate. If we can taste the sweetness of devotion, if we can just capture one drop for a moment, practically speaking, of the sweetness of devotion, then all the other tastes and plans that we have within our mind will dry up or burn to ashes. So what is the prime contamination or impurity that we have? The contamination was, Prabhupada explains about it in Sati's situation, certainly ours, was her concept of the body derived from daksha. But she forgot that bodily relationship in trance. The purport is that when one becomes free from all bodily relationships within this material world and simply places himself in the position of an eternal servant of the Supreme Lord, it is to be understood that all the contaminations of his material attachment has been burned by the blazing fires of transcendental ecstasy. And at the end, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, that sati quit her body means that she gave up within her heart her relationship with daksha. Sri Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also comments that since sati is the superintendent deity of the external potency, when she quit her body, she did not get a spiritual body, but simply transferred from the body she had received from daksha. Other commentators also say that she immediately transferred herself into the womb of Menaka, her future mother. She gave up the body she had received from daksha and immediately transferred herself to another better body. But this does not mean she got a spiritual body. So when Sati burnt up her body in the fire of her meditation, in anger, she annihilated her body in anger. There was a tumultuous roar all over the universe. Everyone was astonished. And the people began to talk. They were wondering, why had Sati, the wife of the most respected demigod Lord Shiva, why had she quit her body in such a manner? So everyone was wondering this. It was astonishing. This is the continuation of this, of the wonderment of people. It was astonishing that Daksha, who was a Prajapati, the maintainer of all living entities, was so disrespectful to his own daughter Sati, who was not only chaste but was also a great soul, that she gave up her body because of his neglect. That Daksha would not, he didn't stop her. He was so hard-hearted that he wouldn't even stop his daughter. Somehow pacify her, placate her, please her, so that she wouldn't do such an extreme thing. How hard-hearted he was. Daksha, they continue, they predicted, who was so hard-hearted that he was unworthy to be a brahmana, will gain extensive ill fame because of his offenses to his daughter, because of not having prevented her death, and because of his great envy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he was so hard-hearted, and he will be famous for having done this. And in fact, Daksha remains famous in this way. So while people were talking amongst themselves about the wonderful voluntary death of Sati, the intendant, so she gave, by her own power, she burnt her body to ashes. So the servants of Lord Shiva who had accompanied her, they became so angry because their mistress had died. So the attendants who had come with her readied themselves to kill Daksha with their weapons. They came forward forcibly. But Bhrigu Muni, who was one, a brahmana there, saw the danger, and offering oblations into the southern side of the sacrificial fire, he immediately uttered mantric hymns from the Yajur Veda by which the destroyers of yajnic performances could be killed immediately. So he offered some mantras, and by the mantras, anyone who tried to disturb a sacrifice would die. So when Bhrigu Muni offered oblations to the fire, immediately many thousands of demigods named Rivus became manifested. All of them were very powerful, having achieved strength from Soma, the moon. When the Rivu demigods attacked the ghosts and Guyakas, the followers of Lord Shiva, who were angry at Daksha due to Sati's death, with half-burned fuel from the yajnic fire, all the attendants of Sati fled in different directions and disappeared. This was possible simply because of the Brahma Tejas, the brahminical power of Bhrigu Muni. And we'll just read Prabhupada's purport there. The word Brahma Tejas used in this verse is significant. In those days, Brahmanas, these are the intellectual class, was so powerful that simply by desiring and by chanting a Vedic mantra they could accomplish very wonderful effects. But in the present age, of degradation, there are no such powerful brahmanas. According to the Pancharatrika system, in this age, the entire population is supposed to consist of sudras because the Brahminical culture has been lost. But if anyone displays the signs of understanding Krishna consciousness, he should be accepted according to Vaishnava Smriti regulations as a prospective brahmana and should be given all facilities to achieve the highest perfection. The most magnanimous gift of Lord Chaitanya is that the highest perfection of life is available in this fallen age if one simply adopts the process of chanting Hare Krishna, which is able to bring about the fulfillment of all activities and self-realization. So by chanting Hare Krishna, regardless of what kind of family we are born in, doesn't make any difference. If we just chant Hare Krishna, we can be elevated to the highest position. So therefore, according to the Vaishnava scriptures, that anyone will be recognized as a brahmana, or like the leading in the those who advise within society, if he has the tendency to make spiritual life the center of his life, and that should be encouraged. So I found one tape where Prabhupada explains this point in a very similar way, and it's interesting to hear it in his voice. I hope we have the right spot there.
We form exactly the Vibhut Muralidha, two hands.
Is this side B?
That is Krishna's original form. Vibhut Kanna.
Is shirts?
Huh? Side B is showing this way. If you look through the side B.
And there's only a little left on the tape?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's see.
I can
tell
you that.
No, no. Let's see. Varaha
vatam samasitam vidasandarangam kandarpa koti kaniya visesa sogam govindamadipunsam. So, we have to understand Bhagavan and we have to hear from him, and he is speaking perfectly in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and if you take it, Jagviditva, if you are fortunate enough to understand the words of Krishna and Kapilde, then the result will be Vimocheta. Immediately become liberal. If you are fortunate enough, if you are intelligent enough to understand the words of Kapil Dev or Krishna or Rishabh Dev, there are so many incarnations, then Purusha Prakutim, Vimuchetam means become free and contaminated. What is that contamination? Prakutim. This material infection, that I am Brahmana, I am Kshatriya, I am Vaishya, I am Shudra, I am American, I am Indian, and this and that. These are all practice, material qualifications. Even if you are perfect Brahmin, that is also material qualification. But in the platform of pure Brahmin, you can have the chance of understanding the aprakita. Therefore, you have to become Brahma, qualified Brahmana. Then there is chance. So in this age, it is very difficult to become exactly Vedic Brahma. That is very, very difficult because everyone has become Shudra. Kalu Shudra Sama. In the Kali Yuga, you cannot find out exactly qualified Brahma, very clear. Therefore, Vaidic Brahman is not possible. It is our movement, Krishna consciousness movement, is creating Pancharatriki Vidhi. Pancharatriki Vidhi Brahman means there is no evidence or there is no certainty whether one is a Brahmana or son of Brahman, because so many things are lacking. But if he has got little taste for Krishna understanding, he should be encouraged. That is Pancharatri. Just like if there is little fire, you faint. Faint. And it will come out a big blazing fire. So this Krishna consciousness movement is trying to do that. It is easier because in the Shastra it is said by Sukadeva Goswami that there is one opportunity. My dear king, Parikshit, I have described to you about the faulty nature of this Kali Yuga. But there is a very good opportunity for the people, fallen condition soul of this Kali Yuga. What is that? Now, karvam dosa nirayam asti dhiko mahanu. In the Kali Yuga, it is like the ocean of fault. So, but still there is one very good opportunity. What is that? You chant Hare Krishna and become liberated and go back home, back to home. Thank you.
So Prabhupada in that little segment said the same thing as in this purport. That in this age one can't be sure who is Brahman, who is not Brahman. Of course in today's society these things are more or less irrelevant. No one talks in Australia who is a Brahman and who is not a Brahman. But a Brahmana means one who is capable of advising and leading society because of the purity of his heart. And in previous ages, the families were they would intermarry very carefully, so that the people produced in the family, the brahmanas would be very, in the Brahmin families they would only marry other brahmanas. And so they were, the purity of the lineage would be kept. And warriors would only marry other warriors. And merchants would only marry merchants. So therefore, in those days, the people who had mercantile tendencies, they were really merchants. And the people who were intellectuals were really finely intelligent. And the people who were warriors were really warriors. They had that courage, that spirit. Nowadays, everyone is confused. Everyone has a little bit of everything in them and they don't know whether they should be doing this and who are they and whether they should be doing that. And whatever they do, they won't be satisfied. Because if you follow one part, three parts won't be happy. So this is Kali Yuga, but in previous ages, the you can call it breeding, although it's a funny concept when we think of in relationship to people. But the breeding of the people, the bodies, was very fine and kept in a particular way. So, in Kali Yuga, no one can see who are those truly capable intellectual Brahmins are. So we don't follow the Vedic system in seeing who is a Brahmin. Rather we follow, as Prabhupada explained, the Pancharatriki system, which means that if someone just has a spark in them, a spark of the tendency to use their life properly, then though that spark should be made to blaze through encouragement by letting them act, make the attempt to act as Brahmins. Let it blaze, let that tendency blaze, because no one in this age is pure except when we're purely ridiculous. That way, sometimes we are. But no one is purely good in this age. But let that goodness, whatever sparks of goodness we have, blaze through. Although there are so many bad things of Kali Yuga, Prabhupada quoted that verse from the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam, Kalo doshanadhira janastiya komahanguna kirtanadeva krishnasya mukta sangha paramvajaya. Just if we can chant Hare Krishna and chant Hare Krishna, that spark of sincerity can blaze and flame, and we can fully burn to ashes all the impurities and debilities of the age, and allow our spiritual identity to come forward fully. So that's really the conclusion of the whole thing. Okay, thank you very much. We're already late, so we won't go any further. So we'll continue with this chapter 5 tomorrow. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.